Hello, I'm Jill Dittmeyer, curious journalist, arts and culture enthusiast.
And I'm Mark Kiesling, founder and executive director of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we use art to teach science. So welcome to...
She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
We are coming to you live from the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, and we welcome you to join us for this next hour of edutainment as we learn more about the creative interaction between artists and scientists.
And we'll get an update on our ever-changing environment from our eco-reporters.
And you will also have a chance to win a prize when we ask you about things you can't explain. And then we're going to turn the tables and let you ask us something that you've always wanted to know about art and science in our other segment called Things I'm Curious About. All of this on She Says Art.
And He Says Science. Joining us live in the studio today are...
David Landis, artist.
And Andy Gavran, physicist.
And this unlikely pair are actually working together on a project that is called Chaos. Ooh, that gets us thinking right off the bat right there. So we're excited to have you guys both in studio with us. So welcome to the program today. And golly, Chaos, Mark.
I know. David, it didn't really grow out of the conversation on Chaos. It grew out of a conversation about motion. Can you tell us more about that conversation that spawned your idea?
Sure. Thank you. That's nice to be here. I'm glad to talk about this. This is fun. This is what I enjoy. I'm a kinetic sculptor. I focus on motion and capturing motion, and I'm always looking for where can I find motion. And as an artist, you're always looking for a new and different and expressive way to capture and communicate what it is you see and how you see the world. So that's kind of the general beginning of the idea.
And so once you had that idea, where did you go from there?
Like I said, I'm always looking. And so I found this idea where I found objects, these balls that would roll randomly. And I thought, what can I do with these? And I like the motion, and how can I capture that motion? And so a process of discovery and experimentation, and created little stands for them to roll around in and bounce around against each other, and it's actually one of those things that you need to see.
So did you actually have these balls around your house that you tripped over or something? How did you identify the ball as the motion you wanted?
Actually, the ball is a cat toy.
Oh, my
uh-huh.
God.
And I saw the randomness in this motion. And so you take the tail off the cat toy, and all of a sudden you have this rolling, bouncing, randomized robot from a scientist, a more scientific mm-hmm. perspective.
And Mr. Scientist, are you a cat fan? Is that how you got involved, Andy?
I do have a cat, and I had one of those balls. In fact, it entertains small children just as well as it entertains a cat. I always called it the weasel ball because it comes with like a weasel tail, and it rolls around randomly. And David brought these in to a group where we were both participating, and he had found a really clever way of attaching pens to them so that the trails of these things moving around were recorded. And I thought, wow, that's such a cool thing. I wonder if I can simulate that motion on a computer. So I set about doing that, and it took me a little fooling around to do that, but I eventually created a program that reproduces something very like what David was doing, and I brought it in on my laptop. It's like, David, look at this.
Yeah, and it was interesting to see that a scientist goes in a totally different direction or begins to experiment and play with it in a different way than I would. Mm-hmm. I've had other science and more technical people look at it and all try to figure out, they look at the piece of art and they try to figure out, how is this created? What is behind this? These images, how are they created? And so to see how Andy came about looking at it and figuring it out and experimenting and playing with it.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that's so interesting about this whole project is that David and I use a lot of that same language of experimentation and trial and error and figuring out ways of accomplishing an end goal. And you wouldn't think initially that scientists and artists would have so much in common. But the fact is we do. Our work process is extremely similar. And exploring those similarities has been a lot of fun over the time.
Because I totally, when I brought that in, it's part of a conversation with the Da Vinci Pursuit, artists and scientists getting together and communicate. And so when I brought this piece of art in and how we began to discuss how I created it, and a physicist starts looking at it and goes, that's randomness, that's chaos. How can I deal with that? How can I play with that? So I just started a conversation that I didn't expect, that I didn't anticipate. But it's continued to spawn new ideas and new ways of looking at things. So,
did you notice anything in there in the way of that was unusual after Andy got his design on the computer?
What do you mean?
Did you see any patterns that were the same, or were they totally random, or was there any similarities to what you were getting with the actual thing?
It's not quite as random. I mean, you begin to create randomness. Randomness is hard to, I would guess, capture. I don't know.
Right. And of course, recreate. What I was doing was tweaking the thing, you know, as a program, it's got lots of parameters. And I could make it do something very regular, or I can make it do something more random. And I was tweaking it, trying to figure out how to make it look as much like David's thing as possible. It's a simulation. It always is going to miss some of the details. But I thought it was a fun project to just try to explore and get close to that.
Well, and it's a way to continue the conversation. It's a way to keep moving forward. It's not exact. It's not the same. It's a different. It's a offshoot. And you learn something each time you iterate, or each time you change it, or each time you experiment with different ways of doing a similar thing. Mm-hmm. So,
to take it one step further, though, are you, David, were you actually kind of thinking of a toy to create for cats to play with?
No.
To create art? Could that happen from this?
I don't know. We'll see where it goes. It's not where I was headed, but I enjoy beauty, and I enjoy finding beauty where most people don't see it, or even the motion around us, the things that go on around us all the time are creating patterns. We're leaving trails, and now in this digital world that we're living in, we're leaving all kinds of trails. We're leaving all kinds of information. So for me, I'm playing with a lot of different ideas and going, and that's where Andy's idea of capturing and continuing with the data idea began to spawn some more ideas that I'm experimenting with and looking at. So we'll see.
Right.
As a scientist, Andy, though, when you looked at that, did you immediately just think science? I need to find an answer or this or out, as opposed to just creatively playing with it.
Yeah. To me, it was really more a playful thing. Science, yeah, I mean, I could see what it was doing. It wasn't a question of solving something or answering a question. It was really more, to me, a challenge to use the tools that I know as a scientist to reproduce something that was going on in the real world. The fact that it started with a cat toy probably makes it playful inherently, but the fact is the images that are created by those pens as they move around the cat toy in a enclosed space are really wonderful. And David was kind enough to give me one of the drawings that was created by this tool, and I have it framed, and it's up in my living room. It's really quite a beautiful piece.
Even with Andy's modeling of it through computerization, the computer model of it, I even, with the mechanism and the system that I use to do this process, has its limits and has its repetitions and has its quirks that I'm still myself experimenting with and pushing and challenged by and trying to figure out. But it all does start with play, and that's part of the reason I, as an artist, began to do this. Was it was a lot less structured. I'm very structured in a lot of things that I do, and it was just a way for me to let loose and have a little bit of fun and experiment and create something beautiful at the same time.
So Andy, there's some serious science in here in terms of the inquiry of that, right? So David has something that you inherently, when it's physical, has all kinds of things that could go wrong. The flipping of the ball, the motor running, and all that. And then you model it in a computer, and there's less that could go wrong.
Yes and no. I mean, I'm not sure what wrong. There's no right or wrong in this.
Okay.
It's really just, is it doing something that's a little bit interesting? Is it doing something that's extremely interesting? Is it doing something that's so complicated that it becomes uninteresting again? What the eye perceives is related to what is interesting. And you know, that's really an artist's question. What makes it interesting? What makes it visually appealing?
I disagree. I think interesting is we are all interested in things. We work differently. We say scientist or artist, we work from a different perspective, but things are interesting to each of us. He sees something that is interesting to him, and he takes an essence or a point or an observation and plays with it.
Yeah, I was thinking of the purely visual aspect of it, and you know, my eye is tuned to different questions. To me, the question that came up when I saw that work was, how can I make that same kind of pattern? What's going on there? So I was looking at it and I was thinking, okay, so the balls have a trajectory on the plane, but then there's also a rotational aspect. How am I going to build that in? And the pieces, when they get to the edge of your frame, they bounce. Are they going to bounce like a light ray bounces off a mirror? Are they going to bounce like a super ball bounces
like
off
pool
a road? Is it going to be more like a pool ball? Yeah. So I had to fool around with it a little bit to see what behaviors are necessary to get the same appearance.
Right.
And there's probably more than one way of doing it. I found a way.
Yeah, there's lots of ways to do it. And that's what I love about this conversation between artists and scientists and just how it's grown for me personally. It's grown into a larger conversation about playing and experimenting and seeing our world and encouraging all of us to be creative and to express that creativity somehow and to use our own techniques, our own interpretations of the world in ways that can be expanded by creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the back and forth between artists and scientists, we're just coming at it from the same thing from different perspectives, and I just enjoy how that's expanded my perception of creativity.
Because most people think, oh, art's fun, science, ooh, not so much fun.
Right, but science is fun, and science does give you a tremendous opportunity to express creativity and to explore the world around you and explore ideas. And one of the things that I think people often mistake about the difference between art and science is that they feel like science, you're always right. And that's not true. Science just moves forward by one mistake after another. It's a series of mistakes. And sure, we're always trying to do better. But one of the things that I'm constantly trying to explain to students is, yes, you have to make mistakes. You learn by making mistakes. You move forward by making mistakes. And sometimes what appears to be a mistake turns out to be a discovery.
Or a beautiful piece of art.
That's
the beauty of it, and that's what I am working to communicate to people is create, experiment, play, try, and you're going to fail. We all fail, and I think a lot of us have lost the ability to fail. We're afraid to try because we're afraid to fail, and I just want to – I'm working at that myself. I'm working at experimenting and playing, and I've learned so much from – that scientists fail. That's their focus, is a hypothesis and a failure or a success or an unexpected discovery. So,
well, we're going to come back with some more unexpected discoveries and maybe some more cat toy talk, too. What do you think, Mark?
I hope so.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back shortly. You're listening to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Welcome back to She Says Art.
And He Says Science. Well, coming up, we're going to check with our eco-reporters. But right now, we're talking with David Landis and physicist Andy Gavron about their collaboration called Chaos. And so we were on a little bit of a break, and I had a chance to think about a question that I thought might be really important for our audience to know. And that was Mozart, I think of the physicist Feynman, people get this idea that people are, it's magic. They get a thing in their head, it's all fully formed, it's perfect from the get-go, and yet you guys are talking about failure. Can you talk to me about that?
Sure. It's a
process.
It is a process. It's a practice. It's a, I am passionate about creativity. I'm passionate about encouraging creativity. And as I've spoken with people, when they see my art, they often wonder or amazed or look at it and go, how did you do that? And nobody sees the box of failures back in the studio, the broken parts, the things that didn't work, the hours and hours and hours of struggle. And as I've talked with scientists, and we all work through that process, and my purpose is to encourage people to continue to accept that we're going to fail. We're going to come up against brick walls that don't seem to be surmountable. So,
yeah, and it's very much the same way. I mean, if you go into a scientific lab day after day, you see a lot of people sitting there doing repetitive things some of the times, and other times they're sitting at a desk planning what they're going to do next. And it's not all jumping from one discovery to another. Those times do occur when all of a sudden everybody in the lab is jumping up and down, screaming, patting each other on the back. But those times don't happen every day. And in fact, a lot of the experiments that you begin or the theories that you try or the programs that you try to write don't work out at all. And you just say, okay, that didn't work. Going back to the drawing board.
So we hear a lot of times, or at least I do in my work, a lot of times where somebody that's younger or even older, but particularly younger, will say, you know, I can't do science or I can't do art. And are they looking at that not the process, but they're looking at, I can't make it that perfect from the get-go?
We all start with, I mean, if you have a vision of something, it's that frustrating between the vision and the end product, that hoped-for result, and all the work that goes into it. And I want to encourage, and I always work to encourage anybody I talk to, that's a long process, but it's a process that's worth doing if it's something that you enjoy. It's how you see the world. I also work as a firefighter, and I didn't before, but now as I've especially been a part of these art science conversations, I see how we've separated out ourselves into different segments. There's a creative part, there's a scientific part, there's a mechanical part, there's a medical part that I do in my job or a firefighting part. But creativity is at the core of all of those things. The creativity shows itself in different ways. It comes through different processes, but the essence of it is still a creative process.
Yeah, I think generally, to go back to your question, Mark, people, and especially young people, often see doing science or doing art or whatever as doing what they see in school. And it's not always presented exactly the way it really is in the real world, as it were. Science is a very collaborative process. I work with a whole bunch of people, and sometimes there's parts of a project that I can't do that someone else can. And on another day, I may be doing something that one of my colleagues is having trouble with. So we're working together. We're working through problems. And it's not perfect the first time. Even those great people, I can't speak for Mozart, but I can certainly say Einstein had a lot of struggles. There were parts of developing some of his theories that he struggled with for years and years, and it was very frustrating for him. And there were some of his major work, he was almost scooped on by other people who were better mathematicians than he was. He was very good, but he wasn't a professional mathematician. He was a physicist. He had great insight about the world, but there were tools that other people could use better. And by working with them and talking with them, he found ways of expressing his ideas mathematically that he couldn't do on his own.
Working with and talking with Andy and other scientists, something that's been very enlightening or reinforcing is just how we can discover or experience things from different perspectives, which opens up our own perspective in a different new way.
And you alluded to it a little bit, David. We want to learn a little bit more about each of you, too, and how you got to where you are right now, sitting in the studio talking about art and science, of course. But you are a fireman.
Yes.
How does the fireman become the artist, or vice versa?
Part of that struggle. And part of the reason I'm here, part of what I work to share with people is to encourage people to embrace who they are and embrace the ability, a lot of the ability to accept failure or accept the, be willing to accept failure is a personal courage, a personal ability to say, I'll do this even if I fail. And as a firefighter, it took a long time for me to come back to art after I had left it for a long period of time, just because the rest of the world didn't encourage it, or I didn't personally understand how I could integrate that. And now I see the whole world as creative, and whether it's technical or whether it's firefighting or whether it's artistry or however it shows up, creativity is at the heart of it.
And why did you always think had to be one or the other?
I think it's part of the world that we're in. We all go to our corners and we don't come out. And especially with talking with Andy and other people in other fields, it reignited that or clarified that perception or that understanding that as a firefighter, if I go into a burning building, I'm visualizing what it is. If that building's full of smoke and I can't see anything, all of a sudden my creative ability to visualize and to see things that don't exist is a useful tool. Or to cut apart a car in a wreck, you begin to understand how things are constructed. So all those elements that come together in different ways.
And you've kind of taken some of those elements to create your art. What type of art do you make?
I'm a kinetic sculptor.
Which
means I focus on motion, and I try to translate that. Sometimes that is a three-dimensional sculpture that moves. Sometimes that's a two-dimensional or a flat piece of art that's created out of motion. Sometimes it's capturing motion in other ways. But that's just how I see motion going on all around us all the time that so many people ignore and don't pay attention to. And I'm just excited by that and interested by that. So that's my focus.
And Andy, did you just wake up as a kid and say, I'm going to be a scientist?
You know, I really, in a way, did. I always was interested in science.
There's always one out there.
You know, yeah, it's true. But it was a lot of trouble to get there, you know? I mean, there were times that I was taking classes and struggling and, is this really for me? And some of it was just stubbornness and...
But what was it when you wanted to be a scientist? What you wanted to discover? You wanted to solve? You wanted to...
No, I just wanted to play with stuff that was cool. You know, I thought the stars were really cool. I thought that chemistry was really cool. You know, you could make stuff. You could make stuff blow up. You could, you know, see stuff far away. It was really more the play of it. Science is not about facts. And it is not about the sort of dry stuff that you can put on a multiple choice test. Science is about that creative part, that discovery part, and I always found that fascinating.
And that's that passion that you've got for science that takes you through those dry, hard parts that you have to do.
Absolutely. You keep your eye on the fact that there's a cool part out there.
When you're both describing this really great thing about just playing, and if I could get anything across to the audience, it would be the passion that I see in your faces, the way you light up when you mention the word play. Mm-hmm. And it is not really thought of as something, Jill, as a profession.
No, it's not. No. Or if it is, it's looked at in a distasteful sort of way.
As it doesn't produce anything.
Right. So sometimes people look at artists and they're like, what do you mean? Yeah. We're going to pay you for that?
And the more creativity I can, if you want to look at it from a practical, real-world, hard product point of view, as a firefighter, the more creative I can be in solving problems that I've never seen before. 911 presents a problem, a challenge, a puzzle that you've never seen before, and you bring a skill set to it, and you have to think on the fly, and you have to experiment and do the best you can to solve that problem. But you have to keep moving. You have to keep moving forward. There's time. You have to move. And that's what a lot of what I've learned as an artist who would like to sit around and contemplate and look and, yes, be afraid of failing, is I've learned to keep moving, keep solve the next problem, solve the next problem, and just keep working it out. So,
right. And that's very much the same thing that we do as scientists and that our colleagues in engineering and technology do as well. You know, my teaching portion of my job, I'm mostly working with engineering students. And what David just said is exactly what I tell students. There's no money in solving problems that have been solved before. The goal is to learn to solve problems that have not been solved before, and often to solve them fast or solve them cheaper or better than other people have solved them before. So learning to get out of that comfort zone and not be trying to solve problems that, oh yeah, everyone knows what the answer to this is, that's not the interesting part. The interesting part of science and engineering is solving problems that haven't been solved before.
Which takes courage and a willingness to fail and a willingness to try.
Absolutely.
And it's almost this chaos project is kind of moving in that direction as you get into it even more. Maybe other options and applications for it will arise.
It's spawning other ideas.
It could be. It certainly spawns other ideas.
Yeah. What's been going on in your head since you've been messing with this program a little bit?
You know, I think part of it was just... computational physics is not an area that I particularly play in, but it's something that is becoming increasingly important in the field and something that we want to teach our students. So one of the things that project did for me was it gave me the courage to say, okay, I can put together something fairly simple and easy, and I can apply this to my students. You know, I can ask my students to do a similar thing. And I have since created a lab where students create a very basic spreadsheet that allows them to calculate motion in a way that they couldn't calculate it using pencil and paper. So working on that project, if nothing else, gave me the courage to assign my students something a little more out of the box.
Yeah, students are really thanking you now, David.
I just have to say, I wasn't thinking computational physics.
But what's really interesting that you're talking about is this incredible crossover. Often I think people think, oh, well, arts, they can be there for science. They illustrate it or they can make something visible that isn't visible. But you're talking about something more fundamental here. You're talking about giving you the courage to do something or make
Absolutely.
You think differently.
I'm talking about, you know, looking at David's art gave me the idea to create something that I then thought, you know, that wasn't so difficult. I could ask a student to do that. I can create an assignment wrapped around similar techniques that I wouldn't necessarily have learned if I wasn't really fascinated by David's artwork.
And then my spinoff of that was I've seen now that there's we're moving, the future is coming fast, and data is all around us, and I'm seeing that there's potentially ways to capture that data that represents motion and translating it and using other means to translate motion and things that are going on into a art project, art experience, art conversation.
And I think cat lovers are truly hoping that there might be another way to entertain their cats that was never even thought of from all of this. But
it turns out that computers are actually wonderful for entertaining cats.
Absolutely. Don't need thumbs, do you?
Right.
Have either of you tried with your own cats, setting them down with these balls when they're drawn?
No, I don't have cats. My huskies would.
This is another factor of chaos. Right?
Yes,
that's
I
right.
Love
yeah.
it. Very interesting.
Although cat-based art, that could be an interesting project. You know, capture the motion of cats.
Not in my repertoire. I'll talk computational physics.
Okay.
Something to work on. David Landis and Andy Gavern, thank you for joining us to talk about chaos. We'll post some pictures of the produced arts so far on our DaVinciPursuit.com website for certain.
Good.
Stay tuned. Coming up next, our eco reporters. These are the Earth Charter kids. They're going to join us in the studio as She Says Art.
And He Says Science. And it continues here on WICR Indianapolis.
Welcome back to She Says Art.
And He Says Science. Joining us now in the studio are Earth Charter eco reporters. And I want to welcome Sophie Rays and Ella Cumberford Barnett to
and
the studio.
Let's let each of you say hello. Sophie, say hello so we know your voice.
Hey, hello.
Hello, Sophie. Hello, Ella.
Hello.
Great. And eco reporters, how weird is that? What in the world does an eco reporter do?
You guys keep an eye on the environment for us, don't you? And the things that we should be doing to preserve it.
Yeah, we try and preserve our environment for future generations.
And a lot of that started by your involvement with Earth Charter Indiana. What is that organization? How did you guys get involved with that?
Earth Charter Indiana is an organization committed to preserving the Earth for future generations to come. I got involved through my mom and Jim Poyser, and then I brought Sophie in this past year.
Yeah, so I just started when Ella brought me into the Zero Waste program that we're doing at school.
Zero Waste program. We hear a lot of talk about that, about cities trying to do it, and states are trying to do it, but you guys have really funneled that down to start at the very basic level, which is probably the smartest place to start, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's easier.
What is zero waste? What is that?
All right, so the zero waste program is we try to recycle as much as we can. So we'll have different stations with rangers at each station that will direct the other kids in the cafeteria to go through and recycle the stuff that can be recycled. So we have a liquids place so that you can pour out any excess liquids that might be in your milk carton or in fruit containers and stuff so that you can then recycle those things that those things were in.
Yeah, we also use food rescue for people who are food insecure. That goes to about three different organizations that pick it up weekly.
And the zero waste, what's the goal of the zero waste project?
The goal is to reduce our trash so that we're not hurting the environment more than we are already, and so that we can help save it for our future and everyone else's future.
So part of it, I assume, girls, is that you've got this idea of that you're trying to get people a message that there's a lot of waste to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
definitely,
there's that reduce part. But then you're also cutting through the hard part for me, which is to figure out, well, what can I recycle? What can't I? Where can it go? Mm-hmm. And you've got these, would you call them rangers?
Yes.
As part of that? Can you describe what a ranger is?
So a ranger is one of the students at school that we, Ella and I, have taught on the basics of the zero waste program. So they know, they have a list of what is recyclable from our school and what is not, so that they can then direct the other kids through the line that the different stations are at, so that then they'll tell the kids to recycle this or don't recycle that. So it'll just, the students, it's a youth empowerment, so that the students are very involved in it, it's not just Elle and I.
And what are the students' reactions?
Well, it's mostly positive, though there are a few negative reports. Mostly positive, especially from the staff and teachers. They all love the change in our cafeteria, even if it does take a little extra time out of their lunch.
So if we were to come have lunch at School 91, tell me what I would do when I would go through the lunch line. What would I try to look for and do with what I put on my platter?
Okay, so it usually depends on the lunch that you're having. So it varies every day what the containers are, like what the food is in. So sometimes it's recyclable, like sometimes it's aluminum or plastics or stuff like that. And sometimes it's not, like it's a paper. So we have to be careful. And so you would take your lunch and you would start by pouring out any extra milk that you have in your carton. And then you'd go to the next station, which is recycling, and you'd put your milk carton there and anything else that is recyclable. And if you had any questions, you could ask the ranger that was right there. Then you would go to the trash and dump out your trash. And then you go to the trays so that you could recycle your trays. So you can either put it in the dirty trays pile if it has like a bunch of like ketchup and syrup on it, or you put it in the clean trays pile if it just has like a little milk or water, because that will evaporate and then it'll still be clean and can be recycled.
So have you seen any, when people go home, have you heard from your friends? Do they want to be able to do the same thing at home, and do their parents like get annoyed because they want to separate everything, including the food, and have it go somewhere?
Not yet. We've not heard that, though that would be amazing, even though parents might not be too happy about it. Most of the people who do it kind of think that it's a bit of a waste of time, although they know it's important. So I doubt that they would do it at home, but many families at 91 do recycle already.
Well, it doesn't. It seems like a really easy thing to do.
It is.
Yeah, it is a bit hard to set up at first, but once it gets going, it's pretty easy.
And is that part of making a project like this successful when it comes to doing things that are going to save our Earth, finding ways that everybody can do something that they relate to in an easy way? Or is it more about the idea itself that we have to reduce trash and waste? Or do we want to come up with something that's easy way for people to get involved with that?
I think it's a little bit of both.
Definitely.
So you usually do start at the basics, and then you can work your way up to the more extremes. And then people will catch on too and start doing that at home, and then it'll just spread. So then their friends would do it, and then those friends would do it, and then the friends of those friends would do it, on and on and on until everyone's doing it. And then we can work our way up to the more extremes of it. So,
and at School 91, do you do other projects as well along the zero waste line, or are you guys trying to get everybody kind of eco-friendly over there?
Well, we are mainly focused on our zero waste program, although we do have a garden that's tended to mostly over the summer by volunteers. Our school is in no idle zone, or supposedly. My brother is actually trying to reinforce that at the moment.
Everybody wants to leave their car running, right? They don't want
to
pick up, turn it off. That kind of thing. What has been the reaction from the different grade levels there? Do you see the younger kids are more involved or the older kids? Oh, Sophie's snickering over here.
Yeah, it's funny. Our grade level, so like 4th, 5th, and 6th, is actually the worst group that we have.
Why is that?
I think because it's our age group and they don't really want to listen to us. Mm. And a lot of them do it well, but some of them just don't like it.
Scoff at the whole idea.
Well, you know, it's something that we were just earlier in the show, we were talking with an artist and a scientist about.
Right.
You can't be afraid of failure because you learn from your failures, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What have you guys learned so far while you're trying to make the zero waste program go?
Well, on our first day, we had the line in a completely wrong place in the cafeteria. And that didn't go well at all because there was only one way you could go through it instead of two. Now we can get the kids out of the cafeteria twice as fast, which limits the time they're in the cafeteria, and that in turn makes them more enjoyable to work with, I guess, since we're not taking too much out of their recess time.
And you've already made it pretty much a success. How much trash are you keeping away from School 91 with this project?
75% of 75% of our trash has been reduced since we started this last fall of 2017.
That's pretty good odds, I'd say.
That's a lot.
I'd say that's quite successful.
So a part of this, you know, this is interesting to me because a part of this, you're doing some math, right, to calculate your percentages and you have to weigh things and you have to figure out the plastic issue, which is really difficult. Although I would assume at school you have a similar plastic, so once you get on to what it is, it's a little easier than I do at home.
Yeah, at school I think it's all the same plastic.
Yeah, I think it would be a little
IPS
easier.
IPS uses.
So do you have a message that you want to give to IPS about what they should do?
Yeah, so like Sophie was saying, there are these trays or containers in the hot lunch that are paper, and they should be able to be recycled, but they can't be because they have this weird coating on them. We've not actually determined what the coating is, so that makes it really hard to recycle. So to stay on the safe side, we've not recycled it. So our message to IPS, after we've perfected or nearly perfected 91, our message will be we're going to go to IPS and ask them to change the items that the containers that they package our hot lunch in.
Wow.
Well, will you ladies come back again and keep us updated on that?
We'd
on
love
the zero
to.
Waste product, yeah. And about getting those other items changed,
yeah.
too. Because, like you said, it takes one to start it, but everybody needs to follow along that mm-hmm. path,
yeah.
too, don't they?
It'd be our pleasure to come back.
Ella and Sophie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carry
thank
on.
You for having us.
Yay, Earth. And we're going to come back in just a moment, and you are going to have a chance to win a prize when we pose our weekly question called Things You Can't Explain on She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
Welcome back. I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
And I'm Mark Kiesling.
And you are listening to She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
And it's time now for you to use your curious brain to win a prize.
Whoa. We want you to send us an email to WICR@thedaVinciPursuit.com. That's DaVinciPursuit.com. And Jill. We're going to call this segment Things You Can't Explain.
That's pretty explanatory.
Yeah.
But we need a question.
Well, in keeping with the current excitement over the Star Wars movie, by the way, which I thought was awesome, I have a following question. So Star Wars Obi-Wan Kenobi said that the Force surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. What could be the possibility? What could he possibly be talking about? And what literally would bind the galaxy together while also penetrating us? You know, this sounds like what is, you know, some of those old riddles of, you know, what's
right.
red, black,
you know,
and white all
I'm
over.
I'm thinking like glue, super glue or tape. I don't think that's probably the
know.
Answer.
So, but what could be passing through and keeping the Earth together at the same time? That's an interesting question.
Mm.
And so, again, we'd love to have you email us that question.
Well, the answer.
The answer.
We want
no,
the answer.
I guess the answer.
Yeah, we know the question, but we need the answer. And if you want to do that, send your email to WICR@thedaVinciPursuit.com. And when we get all those guesses together, Mark,
pick the correct one. So once we've got them, then we are going to put it up on the next time we have a show. And since it's our first one, we don't know exactly when that will be, but we are ready to have it be up. And we will actually have that answer from one of our people who got it correct.
And you'll win
there.
A prize.
And you will, a really cool prize.
That's right, the WICR goodie closet. We're going to scavenge through there and find something for you. We also are going to be including every week another segment that's called Things I'm Curious About. And at this point in time would be when you could actually call in and let us know some art or science question that is just burning in your head. but we're not taking calls today. So if you do have something that you are curious about, you can email us that. And that is, once again, wicr@thedaVinciPursuit.com. But in order to get this segment going, Mark, we had to come up with a question. And you're really curious about something.
Yeah, I've been kind of, you know, it's spring, looking around. So my question is, Jill, how do birds pee?
Very carefully.
That would be true. But have you ever gotten wet?
Yes, but usually it's not just pee. It's almost like poop.
Ooh. It's like, disgusting.
It is disgusting.
Yeah.
So how do they pee?
I don't. Well, we're going to wait and let our callers try to figure that out.
Oh, I thought we were going to answer that burning question.
Well, we could. Mm. But I want them to think for a second.
Okay.
And think in their mind, how do you think birds pee? Because the answer is really kind of complicated. So they do produce urine.
Okay.
Right? So it's a living creature, produces waste in the form of water and urine.
We see stuff on our cars, on our sidewalks, on everything. So but we know what happens.
Jill, have you ever wondered why it's so their poop is so kind of liquidy?
No, not really, but I am now. Now I'm very curious about
this. So
does that
give you a hint?
It probably should.
If their poop is more liquidy than you would think, wonder where that liquid's coming from. So it's interesting. Birds have this special adaptation of where the urethra, which is the part that we pee through, does not connect to the outside world. It connects to the inside world.
Oh.
And it's mixed with their poop. And so birds pee and poop at the same time.
One-stop shopping for
the birds. One-stop shopping.
So that will make me be more aware of when I see a bird up on the wire and I'm maybe thinking about walking underneath there.
That's right. You don't have to worry about them peeing on you.
No.
Just both.
And it also makes sense when you look at it on the ground or wherever it lands, how it is kind of scattered.
And why it
around.
Has kind of a what we call that urea smell, that sulfury smell sometimes. Yeah, because it has a lot. And not only is it what they're eating in the terms of grasses and things, but they're, you know, the one that I really hate, though, is I really hate going along a trail on a bike and having to ride through goose poop.
Oh, yeah, because it sticks with you.
It sticks with me for the day.
The aroma, if nothing else.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Ooh.
So.
Well, we'll work on finding trails without goose poop on it, I guess.
That'll help me.
But now we know how birds pee.
Right. And in the future, what we'll do is ask this just like we did. And hopefully we will have a way of getting an answer for
Well, no, I think we want people to ask us a question, what they're curious about.
You're right.
Yeah, so we have two different segments here, and we've probably
confused
So
even I get it
people.
Confused.
You can't, but we'll have an answer, because the things I'm curious about, if you out there, our listeners, have a question about art or science that you're curious about, send us an email, let us know that, and we're going to find an expert to answer that question for you. And today, Mark was the expert because he's the one that came up with the question, and Mark is a scientist, so he found the answer that way. But remember, we're also offering you the opportunity to win a prize by answering the question that we asked, the things you can't explain, and that is all about the
Star
binding
Wars.
Of the gallery. All right. We've asked a lot here in this last segment, but what an interesting hour that we've covered a lot of topics here with Andy and David and their chaos project, and we're going to put a picture of it up on the DaVinciPursuit.com website.
Right.
And also Sophie and Ella, those great eco reporters from School 91 and their Zero Waste Project, they are also going to share some pictures as well of the accomplishments that they're making over
there. And as we go forward, we hope that you'll be able to see some of what we're able to see in terms of the work that these people are doing.
And there's a lot of it going on out there, and those Earth Charger kids are doing fabulous things, and so they're going to be our regular contributors. We're also working on some other segments with some interesting science and art people in town who are going to be in here on a regular basis. And then we've also got two new artist-scientist guests that are going to be with us in our next show, as
That's
a matter
right.
of fact. Yeah.
So next week, our guests are going to include techno-scientist, which is kind of an interesting title,
but
somebody who works with electronics and music, and Alex Porter, and somebody that's kind of famous to probably the WICR crowd, which is jazz composer Becky Archibald. And what they've created is a mind-bending musical piece called The Magical Willow Tree.
So we're going to hear all about it and hear from both of them on our next episode. And by the way, our music, that's from Becky Archibald, too.
It is.
She's contributing quite a bit to us. But thanks for joining us here for this hour of edutainment. Don't forget to email in your answer to the question and give us a question that we can hopefully answer next time when we get together and join you when She Says Art.
And He Says Science.
In the meantime,
stay curious.